From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. Democrats are on the verge of passing the most sweeping climate change bill in U.S. history, part of a $740 billion budget deal senators approved after a marathon session. Here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The Senate has now passed the most significant bill to fight the climate crisis ever. And it's going to make a difference to my grandkids.
The measure also has provisions to bring down the cost of health care and seeks to pay for it all with corporate tax increases.
Let's look at the climate change portions of this bill with Bloomberg News climate reporter Zahra Hirji. And Zahra, there's a lot to dig into here. $370 billion in this bill that's expected to change consumer energy behavior and help power plants cut carbon emissions, among other things. So the bill's been analyzed by some independent research organizations. What did they find?
So there were at least three different groups, climate modeling groups, that came up with their own analysis of what was in the bill. Admittedly, they were all preliminary analyses, but they were roughly in agreement that the big takeaway is this bill would help bring U.S. emissions down 40% compared to 2005 levels by 2030, so in less than a decade. And that is not quite President Biden's goal of cutting emissions 50% or 50 to 52% by the end of the decade, but it's really close.
There are provisions in there to boost fossil fuel productions. There's language about oil and gas leasing. So it was a compromise. Why are those oil and gas measures in the bill?
Well, it's true that there are these provisions that would expand the amount of land, public land, available for oil and gas leasing over the next couple of years. That was a crucial piece for getting West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin on board with the bill. He is more than many Democrats kind of pro-fossil fuels, and so having that in there was crucial to get his support. But the analyses are pretty clear that despite the emissions that would be generated by additional oil and gas production caused by this bill, that it is far outweighed by the climate savings you get from the billions and billions that are going towards expanding renewable energy, expanding energy efficiency. One analysis specifically said it was like one ton of emissions from fossil fuels compared to 24 tons of savings.
Wow. Can you tell me a little bit about the consumer tax credits and incentives in this bill that are designed to sort of nudge people toward cleaner energy behavior?
Yeah, there are a couple different types. You can have tax breaks or rebates. Kind of the difference is how soon someone can get that money. The big one is for electric vehicles. There's one for new electric vehicles. There's also one for used electric vehicles. That's a really big deal because nearly three in four cars sold in the U.S. are used. Many of these kind of tax breaks or incentives are really targeting kind of low and middle income populations and families because they're really trying to help the people that maybe cannot afford to make these changes now. This could be the boost they need.
So then let's talk about the industrial portion of this and how this might reduce emissions from power plants. What does it do in that area?
I think the biggest thing is it extends the kind of congressional tax extension for renewable energy. When you're building huge, massive, say, solar farms or wind farms, no, it's not like that's going to be built in a day or even in a year, and you want to be able to plan years, decades out. This is adding certainty to that, and it's extending the timeline. So not only are there going to be these tax credits for wind and solar, there's some for batteries, and a really big one actually is for carbon capture and sequestration. And while those technologies may exist today, it's not that we don't know if we can get them to work, they are really expensive. And so it's not necessarily economically feasible for big power plants to want to kind of put them in place. And this tax credit could potentially get them there.
It sounds like what you're saying as a climate reporter is that overall this bill is a major win for action on climate change. Is that sort of the bottom line here?
Absolutely. And one thing I like to kind of, when I'm thinking about the science and what does it really all mean, you know, over the last couple of years, climate scientists have really come to understand that every tenth of a degree of warming will lead to worse climate impacts. So we're already at 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming compared to pre-industrial levels. And that means at 1.2 degrees and 1.3 degrees, there will be worse climate impacts. I'm talking worse heat waves, more intense floods. So we're on a track to much more warming without this bill.
Zahra Hirji is Bloomberg News climate reporter. Thank you so much, Zahra.
Thanks for having me.
The budget deal that passed in the Senate yesterday also has provisions to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. It continues Affordable Care Act, health care subsidies, and taxes corporations to help pay for all of it. The bill now goes to the House, and because Democrats are in the majority there, they're expected to pass it on Friday. With us now is Congressman Ro Khanna, a progressive Democrat from California. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So your thoughts when the bill passed successfully through the Senate, what were you thinking?
It was one of enthusiasm, joy, a reminder of why I do this work. I mean, this is the largest investment in climate in our history, or frankly, that any single country has made. And it's going to mean clean manufacturing is coming back to the United States. There are provisions that have domestic content laws that prioritize American manufacturing. And then, as you mentioned, it's going to lower prescription drug costs and expand health care coverage.
Like any bill that actually makes it through the Senate, there are compromises in there. Senator Bernie Sanders tried to add provisions for a child care tax credit and providing dental and vision care to some Medicare recipients. He did not succeed. Also, the cost of insulin will not be capped for people who pay for it through private health insurance. Do you imagine there may be an attempt in the House to add those things back in?
Obviously, I support Senator Sanders' amendments. I co-chaired his presidential campaign, and it's about time we have dental, vision, and hearing for Medicare. We need universal child care. But the reality is the votes just weren't there to get 51 votes. It was outrageous to me, though, that we can't get the insulin capped because we had 51 votes for that, and it's an unelected parliamentarian who's blocking that. I don't understand why we just don't overrule the parliamentarian. She's blocking key things that she has no elected authority. And I frankly think she's been horrible in some of the decision making. But we will pass what the Senate passed because overall, this is still a historic bill.
Now, there's obviously a lot of criticism from the other side of the aisle. Let's take a listen to Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on CNN yesterday.
The bottom line, it's not going to help inflation. It's going to make everything worse.
Do you worry that the measures included in this bill will not be noticeable to voters by the time the November midterms happen?
Well, first of all, it will improve the inflation situation. You don't have to take my word for it. You can take Larry Summers' word for it. If you're increasing the corporate tax, you're decreasing the money supply. And when you reduce the deficit that this bill does, that's deflationary. Do I think that this bill is enough immediately? No, I think we still have to take more aggressive action to make sure that oil prices stay low, releasing more strategic petroleum reserve. We need to take aggressive action on food prices at the Department of Agriculture. But I am convinced that this bill long term is going to reduce prices and is going to make manufacturing come back to the United States. And it is going to immediately have an impact on drug prices. People will see relief on their drug prices.
Larry Summers is an economist who was the United States Secretary of the Treasury. Do you see this as a huge win for your party, for Democrats?
I do. I see it as a huge win for the country. I see it as a huge win for the planet. I mean, I was in the Obama administration, and I remember the disappointment where we couldn't get anything substantial for climate in 2008 through 2010. I mean, this is extraordinary. We're going to have now, finally, massive long-term incentives for solar, for wind, for battery production, for heating pumps. We're going to be able to lead the world in clean energy. Now, this is not the end of the game. It's the down payment. But I'm really proud of the president. I'm proud of particularly the young people who have made this climate the priority, and they can take pride in what we've done.
And I assume how it was important to get this done before the midterms, just in case the Republicans take control of the House.
Well, look, I think we have momentum now with this passing, with gas prices coming down, with the outrage at the six unelected Supreme Court justices taking women's rights away from them. But any election is unpredictable. So it was important for us to get this done before the midterms.
Congressman Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to Here and Now.
We all know there are concerns about chemicals in soil and water. It's one reason people buy organic. And it's why it came as a shock to residents of Westminster, Massachusetts, that what's likely sickening many and contaminating more than 200 properties with deadly chemicals is organic compost. The chemicals are PFAS. They're called forever chemicals because they never go away. They're used to make fire retardants, nonstick cookware, even athletic clothing. The EPA recently issued a new warning saying that any amount in water isn't safe. Even small amounts are linked to cancer, low birth weights, diseases. And in Westminster, officials found levels 50 times more than is considered safe. In a moment, a resident, but let's start with Stacey Rubin from the Massachusetts Conservation Law Foundation. And Stacey, remind us, PFAS, what are they?
So PFAS, or per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, are toxic chemicals that have been found in public water supplies, private wells, and groundwater. And as you've mentioned, PFAS has also been found in soil, especially on farms that have applied certain fertilizer.
The source in Westminster, Massachusetts, we understand, the probable cause of the contamination there is an organic composting company. It's one of the largest in the state. Remind us how this might have happened, that PFAS chemicals might have gotten into that compost.
PFAS is everywhere. So there are municipalities throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that are collecting food scraps, which are then ground and mixed with water or other liquid and sent to a wastewater treatment plant. And the byproduct of the wastewater treatment is sewage sludge. And that is sometimes getting sold to composting facilities.
Well, but again, how did the PFAS get in there? We know that the nature of these chemicals is that they resist heat, oil, grease. Your fast food is wrapped in that shiny paper that holds in the grease, and sometimes those papers are getting into compost. How would it get in through wastewater management?
So, for example, somebody is just watering their lawn or their sidewalk, and that gets contaminated or mixed with firefighting foam that was used to put something out or touched some sort of stain-resistant carpet. Or if there is a liner in our takeout food containers that is getting into our food that is then getting mixed and sent to a wastewater treatment plant, unfortunately, yeah. PFAS is just in so many products that then get passed through our wastewater.
Well, the owners of this compost company, Mass Natural, are also devastated by this. Here they are. They think they're doing the right thing, but they were notified in the spring that it is possibly their compost contaminated with PFAS that has made the water on the property 300 times higher in PFAS levels than the state recommends. What can be done here?
It's really a devastating problem. And this is something that individual consumers can certainly take some interest in, but it is a systemic problem that requires new laws. There are more than 9,000 individual PFAS chemicals that are in use today, but fewer than 10 of those 9,000 are regulated and monitored for. And there really isn't a common practice of testing compost for PFAS chemicals. We've already heard at the Conservation Law Foundation from several different composting companies that are interested in independently doing testing for their soil. And there are certainly solutions like ensuring that discarded food scraps are not getting mixed with sewage sludge in order to create that final product that then gets sold to consumers or to farms.
We remember a few years ago, Minnesota settled a lawsuit against the 3M company. The state claimed that they were producing these PFAS products that got into the state's water. 3M had to pay $850 million. But in Westminster, we have a company that thought it was doing the right thing. Organic Compost. Mass Natural was not knowingly producing PFAS. So what more can be done to protect residents and businesses?
There are alternatives to packaging. We also need to make sure that there are regulations that mandate testing of water and soils. If you want to get your water tested for now to see if you have PFAS levels, you're looking at approximately $350. And soil testing is going to cost even more.
Would it help if you do buy something from a fast food place or any place that puts that kind of grease preventive paper around it? Just don't put it in your compost.
Exactly. I think a lot of people will go and get takeout and they'll see something that says a compostable container. In most cases, there is some sort of a liner. If you see any sort of shine, that likely means that there is a liner that is containing PFAS. You know, PFAS has only been around since about the 1950s. We had ways to carry food before that, and we certainly have alternatives in use today.
Stacey Rubin with the Conservation Law Foundation, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, let's now bring in Ann Lutz. She's a child psychiatrist, Westminster resident who told the Boston Globe that composting is her religion. Ann, I mean, is it still? What's happening? What was found on your property?
Well, first, thank you for reaching out. I live in Westminster, a beautiful town in central Mass. Actually, we just moved here about 2 years ago. So it was a few months back that I was getting my mail, and my neighbor across the street said, "Did you hear what's happening? There's a PFAS problem." And I said, "A what? Mm-hmm. PFAS? I don't know what that is." Well, apparently this Mass Natural fertilizer, it's about a mile up the hill, has been for the last 30 years bringing in a variety of materials. And the PFAS levels were found to be some of the highest in the state. And this was discovered actually not by Mass Natural, but by, fortunately, one of the neighbors who happened to check their well. And then they called, I think, DEP.
Well, so, you know, you find out what has happened, that the compost that you put on your land and maybe even compost that in the rain is coming from the compost maker up the hill. You find what about what's in your land?
So there's the compost facility, then there's right next to the compost facility a golf course that pulls a lot of well water. So I actually got my own well tested on my own because when I called the Mass Natural, they're like, "You're not in the site," even though I was down the hill. I'll just say on the side, my husband developed a very unusual demyelinating disease in the last 2 years. I don't know if this is related, but of course it creates anxiety where he could walk 5 miles a day and now needs a cane.
Demyelinating, the sheaths, he's losing the sheaths, the covers on his nerves. I mean, so, of course, you have to wonder. I was going to ask, have you seen any physical?
It's a really hard question. I'm trying to be science-oriented, right? So we got our well tested, and we got the soil tested. And the soil was, I think, like 36 parts per billion, not trillion. And Crocker Pond, I really pushed to get it tested because, of course, it's the children who are swimming in this. That's about 37 parts per billion, but we know that Mass Natural has a tributary running into the pond that's 910 parts per trillion. So it's really concerning how this contamination, this plume, has been spreading.
And I'll just jump in and note that the water standard in Massachusetts is no more than 20 parts PFAS per trillion with a T. So these are considerably higher.
Yes. Yeah, so we have all these dizzying array of questions like, do you eat your food? What about the water? Should we swim in the water? And there's many, many chemicals that are PFAS. But the state has only just been regulating the top six. And so there's a lot of unknowns. And, you know, there's large chemical companies that have been using this for years. And it's been hard to navigate the complexities of what is it? What does it do? How has it affected us? Oh, my God, what's going to happen? And really what I've learned is over the last 30 years, more of the companies have been responsible for their own cleanup, and the DEP has sort of been overseeing them, but it's really the companies taking charge. And that's problematic in many ways, because who's overseeing this? I need to just say there's 88 cities in the state with high PFAS levels and over 170,000 wells. So if you have a well, most people don't check for PFAS.
Right.
When I researched whether compost facilities test for PFAS, almost universally they don't. So there's an issue of groundwater contamination as well. There's no identified level that's determined to be safe. So there's a lot of anxiety, trauma almost, for the community.
Oh, and no, it is trauma. I mean, I'm reading about your neighbors, the Ryans, Tom and Sue, and they have health issues. Same as you. This was their dream home with a garden, with chickens, and they ate the eggs, and now they're crushing the eggs because they don't want anyone to eat the eggs. And, you know, they believe their immune systems are compromised. What are you doing about your produce?
I've let my vegetable garden go, but how do I know that's even worse than what we get in organic? We don't know what organic food is. I mean, organic, really?
This was organic compost, right?
There's no research on how much PFAS is in organic foods. So we don't know what we're eating anymore.
Ann Lutz, a child psychiatrist, and one of the 200 property owners in the central Massachusetts town of Westminster who've discovered that the organic compost they were using has been contaminated with PFAS chemicals, possibly tied to illnesses in the area.
Yeah, certainly. And I just want to encourage every homeowner who has a well to check your well for PFAS.
Ann, I am just so sorry, and I wish you the best of luck there. We'll continue to follow this.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate your time.
We've been following the devastating wildfires and drought in the West, and now there's a new concern. A disease that's already devastated the bat population on the East Coast has reached bats in the West, and because bats help control insects, it's having a terrible impact on agriculture and the ecosystem. Kayla DeRoche of Yellowstone Public Radio has more.
White-nose syndrome, a fungal disease that biologists first found in bat populations in New York in 2006, has been marching west at a rate of roughly 200 miles a year. The cold weather fungus infects hibernating bats. It's devastated populations in eastern North America. Emily Almberg, an ecologist with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, says they got some bad news when they visited Azure Cave, Montana's biggest bat hibernation site, in May.
When the crew went back this year, they did see evidence of a large number of dead bats, and they found about 30 or 40 bats on the cave walls. Historically, they have gone in around the same time and done counts, you know, 1700 to 1900 bats. So just that single comparison of pre versus post suggests there's been a big change.
A change on the order of a greater than 90% die-off in 1 year. Biologists don't have very exact data on hibernating bat populations over time at most sites, which is part of what made Azure Cave so rare in the West. Unlike in northeastern states, bats here winter in more scattered populations, making them harder to track.
We don't have absolute count information about any of our bat species, and that's, you know, we struggle. So we don't know exactly what we're starting with.
They do know that bats play an important role in the ecosystem, feeding on massive amounts of insects. A little brown bat can eat more than half its body weight in bugs each night. One paper estimates the decline in bat populations costs U.S. agriculture $500 million a year. Olmberg says there are less tangible losses, too.
You know, these are long-lived mammals in some cases, and they're social, and you think about, like, you know, the potential cultural knowledge that a community of bats has of the landscape, and we're poised to lose a lot of that. It's a shame.
Conservationists who tracked bat populations in the eastern and central U.S. say white-nose syndrome wiped out the majority of populations they were monitoring, including the little brown bat. Almberg and fellow researchers captured bat calls like this one in a forest clearing recently and processed them on a computer so humans can hear them. It's part of acoustic surveys biologists across North America are doing to map bat populations and track them over time for the Collaborative North American Bat Monitoring Program. Researchers, meanwhile, are looking for ways to interrupt the spread of white-nose syndrome. Jeremy Coleman is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We're working with a group in British Columbia and in Washington State to deploy probiotics, which are microbes that can be put on bats that have antifungal properties that can help them to repel the fungal infection. We're also working with the U.S. Geological Survey to develop a vaccine.
To date, 38 states have reported cases of white-nose syndrome. Even more have found the fungus, most recently in Idaho and Colorado. The fungus and disease remain unconfirmed in a cluster of southwestern states. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to reclassify the northern long-eared bat as endangered in March due to white-nose syndrome and will announce its decision in November. For NPR News, I'm Kayla DeRoche in Billings.
The photos of Emmett Till's open casket in Jet magazine helped spark the civil rights movement. They're in the Johnson Publishing Archive, which contains millions of images from Jet and Ebony magazines. And now, people will be able to see many of those images at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture and the Getty Research Institute. There are unforgettable photos of James Brown offstage, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of Coretta Scott King at her husband's funeral, and much more. With me to talk about it is the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture director, Kevin Young. Kevin, hi.
It's great to be here.
So it's hard to overstate the trove that Jet and Ebony are now making accessible through the Smithsonian and the Getty. During the 80s, Ebony had a circulation of more than 2.3 million. I mean, let's start with just what this means for you in terms of getting access to these archives and being able to make them accessible.
Well, I think like many people, I grew up with subscriptions in my house to Ebony and Jet, or, you know, people would read it in the barbershop or the beauty salon. And having that presence, I think, was so important growing up, just to see oneself in the magazine, but also to see what was happening in other parts of the world. And for many people, I think it was their first trip around the world in a way. It was that Ebony and Jet. I remember vividly Jet magazine having the Who Was on TV, you know, and there were few enough black folks on TV that Jet could list them for the week. And that was kind of such a powerful moment about visibility. And yet at the same time, they had this wonderful trove of photographs, which haven't been seen. And so to see both the photos that, you know, people might know, like the Coretta Scott King you mentioned, but also this powerful array of pictures of everyday folks and famous people on off moments, these wonderful negatives, which amount to over 4.5 million images, is really going to be tremendous. And I think it's going to help people see the history of the 20th century anew.
I don't want to gloss over what you just said, which was more than 4.5 million images.
That's right.
And this is now a project that includes digitizing them. Can you give me an idea of the scope of the challenge before you in terms of preserving these images and making them part of the collection?
Yeah, well, luckily the Getty and the Smithsonian through the National Museum of African American History and Culture have already been engaged in digitizing and processing the collection. We're hoping to have the first tranche of that available next year. And I think that's one of the key things is, and one of the reasons the consortium came together to get the collection in the first place was to make it publicly available and not have these things off away from the public. And our mission is to make them available for people to see, and again, to see themselves and see each other, and to see the ways that Black life was documented since the start of Ebony and Jet magazine.
So I mentioned the images of 14-year-old Emmett Till, his body after he was murdered in Mississippi. And his mother wanted the public to see the extent of the damage to this young boy. Can you tell me a little bit about the importance of images themselves, the sort of unique power, especially of news photos, photos that sort of document everyday life.
It goes from the extraordinary to the everyday. And certainly the pictures that Mamie Till Mobley, that were made available via jet, and Mamie Till Mobley, as you know, insisted on an open casket for her son in Chicago as testimony, as witness. And by jet publishing those photos, it was really transformative. People couldn't deny the horror of lynching, the horror that fell to Emmett Till and that was committed against him. And I think you see how his murder in 55 really influences the civil rights movement. You see the ways, and you know, we have in the museum already Emmett Till's casket, and Mamie Till Mobley entrusting us with that, which we restored and now is one of the sacred spaces in the museum. You can't take pictures. You can only go in there and just pay your respects, but also you feel the weight of history in that room, and it really resonates. And that resonance comes from Mamie Till Mobley's bravery, but it also comes, I think, from the fact that Jet Magazine published those pictures unadulterated and showed you the horrors. And I think that's such a powerful aspect of witnessing. That's what these photographs, I think, writ large do. They witness everyday life, they witness the extraordinary, and they witness this bravery of telling the truth, the unvarnished truth.
You've also mentioned a couple times all of the photographs that are just of Black people living their lives, going about their everyday lives. Can you tell me, as you look through some of them, can you describe a couple of those photos that stuck out for you?
Well, I haven't been through the whole thing. So
yeah, you haven't seen all 4.5.
I think
what have you been
really
doing
remarkable.
With your time?
What's really remarkable is, that everydayness, but also the everydayness of what it takes to put together a magazine. So you'll also get to see, and I'm excited by this, you know, it's the negatives as well as the prints. So you get to see sort of the process of putting together the magazine. It's a working collection in some ways. And so you get to see that firsthand, the kind of markings, what they chose, what didn't make it into the magazine. And you also get to see these wonderful photographers like Moneta Sleet Jr. And I think that's really going to be powerful too, to see the way that someone like Moneta J. Sleet, his staff photography and his winning the Pulitzer for Coretta Scott King photo, as we mentioned, is really powerful. But also, you know, it is that everyday thing, everyday life in Philadelphia or Chicago or the rural South where my family's from. I mean, you get to see that sort of the glamour, but also the other side. And I think that glamour is just as important as marking the everyday life. But the glamour isn't just celebrities. It's also sort of everyday folks and the aspirational quality of Ebony Magazine, I think, you will come through too.
I was struck by so many images from there. There's a great one of Muhammad Ali backstage with Howard Cosell, and there's Thurgood Marshall after the birth of their son, Thurgood Marshall Jr. Are there any images that stick out for you?
I know there's one of like Quincy Jones at home with his kids, you know, like at the kitchen table, he's working, they're, you know, coloring, you know, like, and you don't always get to see that even behind the scenes of people we think of as so famous and who have changed culture. But reminding us of their humanity is one of the things that I think Ebony and Jet do well, and this archive is going to continue to do that.
I mean, the other thing that occurs to me is that by making these publicly available, it might fill in some holes in history. Very often when history books are written, what's available is photos of white life in America, right? Those are the dominant images. And perhaps, historically speaking, this will help diversify our pictures, our images, or memories of American history. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I recall seeing a picture of Debbie Allen and Felicia Rashad, those great sisters, dancing on these stairs, you know. I'm not sure what public stairs they are. But to see that Black joy represented is really going to be powerful. People are going to, I think, turn to that and remind themselves of what we already know. But sometimes we forget, or sometimes, as you said, the public record doesn't always maintain. I think the undeniable quality and the diversity and the breadth and depth of Black life is what the Ebony Jet Archive represents. And the Johnson Publishing Company did that for decades, and to have it here at the museum and to share that with the public and with the Getty is going to be really powerful.
That's Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture Director, Kevin Young. Kevin, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And let's take just a moment to hear from writer Dante Stewart, who recently received a gift of vintage Jet magazines, and we asked him what those magazines mean to him.
Every time I open up that Jet magazine, that Ebony magazine, every time I read the words Black people had during that moment and what was really going on, I'm reminded that I'm a part of a larger story, a larger tradition, something deeper, more lasting than the many ways this country tries to erase us and devalue us and harm us. It shows me and reminds me that grief lets us know that the things never lose their value when they are transferred to hands and hearts that believe they're still precious.
In New York City and Washington, D.C., thousands of migrants, mainly Venezuelans, have been arriving by bus since April from Arizona and Texas. Free rides launched by Republican governors in those states to draw attention to what they say are the Biden administration's failures along their borders, but which the Democratic mayors of both New York and D.C. say is cruel political gamesmanship that is overwhelming their nonprofits and health systems. The migrants cross the border legally, passing a screening that gives them permission to be in the country temporarily while they make asylum claims. Abel Nunez is executive director of the Central American Resource Center in D.C. He joins us by Skype. Abel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And have I got this right? It seems at the heart of this is Title 42. This is the Trump pandemic-era health order that's expelled thousands of migrants. The Biden administration has been trying to overturn that. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has pointed to that as a reason for the bus trips. But those coming in now, those migrants, are allowed to pursue asylum claims because their country, in most cases Venezuela, doesn't accept migrants back. They don't have an agreement. So, I mean, it's not clear they could even be expelled. Have I got that right?
Well, right now, most of the immigrants have what's called parole. They have a permission to be in the country for 60 days, and that, from immigration's perspective, gives them time to apply for any relief that they qualify for, and asylum being one of them.
Right. And these mostly Venezuelans are making asylum claims because of the terrible unrest in Venezuela. Just give us a sense of what it feels like there in D.C. to have these buses pull up.
Well, you know, when it first started, it was surprising because we get no notification officially from Texas, right? We have a contact in Del Rio, Texas, who works for another nonprofit there, and she is the one that provides, you know, when buses are coming, approximately the number of folks. So for us, it's really hard to prepare. But we try to do our best and hopefully serve them as best we can.
Well, look, I mean, we're hearing scenes of these largely men, but also families, getting off the buses and being greeted by nonprofits like yourself, getting maybe a change of clothes from a church, but then sleeping at Union Station. And we're hearing that on one side you might see this group of migrants in a dizzying change of venue from Texas or Arizona to D.C., and then on the other side, maybe American citizens who are homeless. I mean, the governors in both Arizona and Texas feel that they are overwhelmed by this situation, but they do have infrastructure to greet migrants. What do you have?
Well, so I think that you know, a lot of the conversations that have happened in the media are not exactly what's the reality on the ground. I mean, the reality is that for the past 4 months, the nonprofits that have been responding have prevented that. People get not only given clothing and food, but also a ticket to their next destination, where a lot of them have family or sponsors that are waiting for them. The very few that stay are the ones we try to house temporarily. And then if, unfortunately, we can't find additional housing, then yes, we begin using the shelter system that it has. But But the reality in a major metropolitan area, 6,000 people coming in, is not really going to bat an eyelash. Unfortunately, it's the world that we live in. And that's not the case. Again, most have family members, have sponsors.
Did I just hear you say that in a city, 6,000 people coming in, you don't bat an eyelash?
It's unfortunate. You know, I mean, we and I think you were right that we were receiving these individuals and families in the midst of 10 cities.
Can you understand how people in D.C., people in many American cities, as you said, there's a tent population in many mm-hmm. cities right now because of homeless American citizens. Can you see how this would be unnerving to people in D.C., in New York, especially when there are federal funds directed to the borders to help them process migrants?
I understand, you know, where people are coming from, but we must remember this. We did not request the buses be sent to D.C. or New York. Most of the people that are coming through the borders are not staying in Texas. They are also looking to get away. And all we're trying to provide is that assistance, that solidarity to the people coming in to make sure that they get to their final destination and become productive citizens. If we can provide some guidance and some small resources so that then they can become productive citizens, I think it's a win-win for everyone. It's a win-win for the immigrants, and it's a win-win for our nation.
Well, plus we're hearing anecdotes of a migrant who had family, sponsors, waiting for him in Portland, Oregon, and he found himself in New York City. Do you hear anecdotes like that?
Well, we've dealt with that. So we've had to send people back to Houston, Texas, because the buses does not allow them to stop in Texas, but they just took that. We've sent people to California. I mean, if he's willing to spend taxpayers' money to do this program, he should do it in an orderly way. Why doesn't he find out at the border who wants to go to New York? And I can guarantee you he can fill a bus and families will be waiting for them there.
Right.
It's because it's a political stunt. It's a political point, and it's really disgusting.
Abel Nunez, Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.